Facebook. I think Mary or Isa, who's doing that?
Mary.
Okay. In our discussions, one of the first points was general agreement that people want to talk separately about one-off obligations versus ordinary course of business events. With ordinary course, we didn't spend very much, if any, time on, but thought was more, that's when you would expect the portfolio approach to be applied, you know, warranties as an example. Although in our discussions, we did come around to saying that, especially in a large corporation, there's probably a class of litigation that is ordinary course for that company. Not all litigation, but certain classes. The example was maybe patent infringement kind of thing. Might be a class that you would deal with as ordinary course rather than one-off. But for items that do not form part of a portfolio because they are a single item, the greatest desire from the users was for information about the nature, magnitude, and potential recoveries of the claim, and much less focus on measurement at a precise amount. The idea being, and there was recognition from the users, and and I think pleasure that this was the view of users of financial statements from the preparers, that a tremendous focus on trying to get an estimate of the expected outcome and disclosure of what the expected outcome was and explanation of why was probably prejudicial to the interest of shareholders, of owners, and did not want the focus on that, but rather wanted to give users the information to allow them to make their own assessment of what they thought the amount of the exposure of the settlement would be, and any likelihood of recoveries, if there was such a recovery. There was a point made by one of the users that it was unhelpful to have a lot of fine-tuning, small adjustments, if you were in more the expected value approach for a one-off item. So 100 million potential claim, start measuring at 5, move it to 6, move it to 4. That kind of noise was maybe less helpful than just giving people more raw data and allowing them to make their own estimates. There also was a point made about some related issues and where people thought there was a disconnect, that if we were to do a project, we should be thinking about. One was the difference in recognition of contingent liabilities acquired in a business combination. And the other was the borderline between liabilities provisions that were in the scope of 37 today and some risk-sharing agreements that you might be entering into as business activities. And that was kind of noted as, as on the margins as something we'd have to think about if we were to take up a project on 37 and uncertain liabilities. Anything else from members of the group?
Not the case. Then I think we move directly to the Cannon Room group. Peter?
So I think most of the people in our group were also comfortable with probable as the recognition threshold there, although one of the preparers in the group also commented on this inconsistency with the treatment in business combinations and felt it should be the same treatment but would actually go for recognizing them in both cases. And the other parallel that was brought out was with things like warranties and insurance contracts where you've maybe been paid for taking on these risks, and I think there's suggestion you'd be more likely to want to recognise in that case rather than having a gain on day one when you've issued the contract.
Can I just check, Peter, when they said be the same for IFRS 3, so there's a difference between IFRS 3 that doesn't have the probable...
It doesn't have the probable...
...and IAS 37 that does. So were they suggesting to make them the same or just acknowledging...
I think the person who raised the point wanted to make them the same and wanted it to be the same as IFRS 3.
Right.
Whereas I think the rest of the group...
I'm not sure all preparers would be on the same page. So
no.
I'm just reporting back what I heard from the group. And the rest of the group, both preparers and users, were comfortable with probable. There was some discussion about remoteness as a trigger for disclosure, and some of the group, both preparers and users, were comfortable with remote, although I think there was some discussion about how you would assess what remote was. And particular concerns, the larger the sort of tail risk gets, the more likely you'd be wanting to require some disclosure. So they bet the company on that, avoiding a bad outcome, that more likely to want disclosure in that case. On the particular fact pattern, there was a kind of recognition that it was linked to the transaction that's occurred, and if it's such a material transaction, the chances are that even if you think the bad outcome is remote, there will probably be some disclosure about the transaction itself, and so there might be indirectly some sort of disclosure about the circumstances as well. And then we got a little bit into the discussion of measurements. In fact, we went on to briefly discuss the measurement point as well, but I think some of that discussion also came through in the recognition discussion, and it was a suspicion of trying to estimate percentages, particularly in the one-off binary cases with no history to go on.
Sorry, I should throw in on top of that that we, when we did touch on measurement in our discussions, and the concern, you know, I reported the concern about a lot of noise from small movements in low probability expected value. There also was an observation from at least one of the user members. We did not discuss it at length, that once you crossed a threshold and had think probable was implied, that it should be the most likely outcome rather as the measurement approach, but we did not spend a lot of time discussing that.
Did I miss anything from our group?
Any other comments on this?
Maybe a question. What's the board's take, tentative take on this?
We have not.
Oh. We are
a research project.
Because it's at such an early
dangerous
stage.
Question.
Yeah, we'd argue for the rest of the day.
That is why we're asking you.
One thing I would say is that where we're dealing with probabilities, it's not always the case sometimes it is the case the company is in a best position to assess those where you're dealing with very specific things. But very often, the whole market is capable of making those assessments, and it's those situations where one person might say it's X and another person might say it's Y. Both may be correct. It's important then for the narrative to be clear enough to enable the market to make its own mind up about these things. Because I sympathise with the person who said that, you know, nitpicking on the numbers is not really that helpful sometimes, because the market sometimes has two views about what the numbers are, and it trades those views every day. And there's, you know, there are people buying and selling the same piece of data. But with completely different views.
Welcome.
I shared with my group. In another capacity, I've been privy to a little bit of research that certain people have made about the impact. It relates to, in the banking industry, the enormous fines that have been imposed on banks. And the point is that I suspect very few of the banks actually booked the anywhere near the amount of the provisions they finally paid until they actually paid them. And the analysis showed, though, that the impact on the share price when they finally paid was almost nothing,
right?
Because you guys, I mean, people knew there were these issues out there. There was the LIBOR issues or whatever in the banks. So whoever was analysing the banks had already factored in reasonable assessments, and obviously the banks had, you know, had put in some sort of range of things, but they certainly didn't end up putting in their financial statements anywhere near the amount until they finally paid it.
Right.
So the point is, it's hardly putting a stupid figure in the accounts and finally paying a different figure. As long as you're telling people that there's that risk that the figure is not the right figure,
right,
seems not to be market relevant, because you guys.
But maybe in that particular case,
people don't know at all about the claim.
Yeah, well, in that particular case where there was a lot of public information about exactly, you know, what could happen, all you really needed to know was how many potential claimants you had for the market to work out what assessment.
Well, no, it's also, you analysts have to form a view about how. What would be the potential amount of the claims that regulators would impose?
The market could do that as easily as an individual company.
Right. But I think what came out from our discussion overall from both the users and preparers was nobody wanted a surprise about Company A being a company that was being investigated for, let's say, that claim. So the concern was to make sure that non-recognition did not equal non-disclosure of the claim, the amount, the potential exposure.
Okay, then Stephen and Marietta, and then we move to measurement.
So I think I'm hearing that if it's a portfolio of claims, Mary said, then recognize them always, even if the individual claim is less than 50% probability. If you have a portfolio, then you take into account the expected frequency of claims in measuring the outcome for the portfolio. But if it's a single one-off item, then only if the outcome is assessed to be probable, a payment expressed to be probable, would you then recognize. Would the board have to define what is one-off and what is portfolio? Because whilst it might be obvious in some situations, what if I have 10 legal claims but of a different nature? What if I have 100 employment-related claims but they're slightly different? When is something one-off and when is it portfolio? Because you would then flip from one method of accounting to another once you deem that it's part of a portfolio. More of a comment, perhaps, than a question.
Is it? There was a question there, and I would say yes, the board would have to make some kind of definition or a fence post or whatever to make that differentiation. I would just do one comment, is that I personally would be portfolio approach on the portfolio. I wouldn't be expected value. It'd still be more likely than not with respect to the portfolio. So the portfolio in total, if it's more likely than not, then I'm going to have a payment of some kind. And maybe I'm just talking about things that are so detailed it doesn't need to be talked about. But I would use a more likely than not approach on a portfolio.
Yeah, on the portfolio rather than the individual items within the portfolio.
Yes. But yes, you would, to answer your question, there has to be some definition of what's a portfolio. Unit of account.
Just a quick clarifying question to the board, which is, do you actually differentiate between contingent consideration and contingent liability? And contingent consideration is outside of the scope of IAS 37. Because I think that might also explain the confusion of Stephen about the portfolio approach, because I thought that the two were essentially the same, because if you have contingent consideration, then you basically, this is something that you need to pay when it gets triggered and it's outside of your control. So I thought like milestone payments in a risk sharing arrangement were part of this clause, and it was part of sort of regular business, and therefore you have a whole portfolio of, let's say, drugs you in license and you hope a few of them work.
These contingent payments are presumably for things that you've purchased as an intangible asset. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think what you will be governing that would be the requirements of the intangible asset standard to measure them at cost. And there have been questions raised as to whether the cost should include contingent consideration or not. They went to the Interpretations Committee. The Interpretations Committee has put it on hold. And I think it was pending the outcome of the conceptual framework discussions exactly on this issue. So I think it could be something that we'll come back to, but at the moment it's not clear.
Mm-hmm.
But it's more of an asset measurement question at the moment.
It's actually covered in some way this afternoon, and we talk more about PP&E, but the parallels to intangibles are the same.
Then the last one on this topic, Peter?
Yes, I just wanted to comment on Stephen's question, what is a portfolio and what is not? And to me, a key issue is if the company itself are starting to estimate like litigations. Probably if a company goes into the United States in Sweden, they will start including that to some extent in their product calculations and whatever they have. So when the company themselves are starting to estimate them, to me that's a key issue.
Okay, thanks for that. Then we move to measurement and we start with the boardroom group.
Right, that was us. So you get more of me, I'm afraid. I think the sort of conclusions that our group were reaching were very similar to the ones that you've already heard. There was a general consensus amongst the users that what's important is to get disclosure of particular information about the claims, and the disclosure is more important than whatever point estimate has to be put into the financial statements. Now, we had some discussion of the commercial sensitivities of this disclosure, and accepting that there will be some things that companies will not be willing to disclose, there may be some facts that they could disclose that would be very useful to investors, and that could be facts that would give an indication of the boundaries of the range. So one fact might be the upper boundary, which could be the amount claimed or something like that. Another fact could give a lower boundary, which might be an amount that's already been offered in settlement. Now, neither of these would necessarily prejudice the outcome of the case, but would give investors a lot more information that would allow them to make their own estimate of which amount within the range would be appropriate. In terms of, given that even with all this good disclosure, there would be a need to consider one point estimate to put into the financial statements, I think there was general agreement in the group that it should probably be a form of best estimate rather than zero, or a minimum amount, but that companies should be given the flexibility to decide what best estimate actually meant, forcing them to something like a probability weighted average for the possible outcomes is neither desirable nor feasible. That has to be left to them, but in company with a good disclosure of the boundaries, that would give users sufficient information.
Okay, thanks for that. Then
the last one from our group. I would probably echo some of the comments already made, but a couple of general comments. I think there was the members thought it depends upon each facts and circumstances of each case, and it cannot be generalized to the topic of IS 37. And there was a lot of emphasis on how the numbers are determined. With what is the robustness of the process where the inputs are determined, with what rigor are the probabilities assigned. So they thought it is very important that there is enough rigor in assigning probabilities, and it's not just a guesswork of how these numbers are determined. And of course, there was a lot of emphasis on disclosures in many of the cases. They thought good disclosures will help in understanding the information. On specific questions on comparability, they thought comparability may not again be relevant in all cases, so it depends upon whether we are talking about a litigation or a warranty. So comparability is more relevant in a warranty case than a litigation. However, comparability over a period of time for an entity may be more relevant than looking at across the entities for cases like litigation. On which amount they would pick up, there was a mixed view here. A couple of members thought most likely outcome is the best result for this. Although expected value may be used if the probabilities are assigned in a proper way, the rigor is maintained. There was also a view of a binary outcome, that is win or lose, 0 or 100 million. So there was one view which thought this is also acceptable. On 2.3 and 2.4, I think I'll take it together. Again, here they thought standardizing the banding or the distribution of the measures generally may not be very helpful, and it depends upon the facts and circumstances of the case, and the measures depends upon the distribution and how the numbers are arrived. One of the distributions that was mentioned was recurring and non-recurring. So the distribution could be made between recurring and non-recurring items. And 2.5 and 2.6, I'm not sure if there was a consensus in the entire discussion, but I think more guidance on how or when an expected value could be used or when most likely outcome could be used is more helpful in terms of arriving at useful information. So that was kind of a brief overview. If I missed something, please add.
Okay, thanks, Prahlad. And I think we will take another 5 minutes to discuss measurements. Martin?
Yeah. Conceptually, I worry about the concept of most likely, because either it's really truly binary, like 100 million or zero, but in practice, the outcome is it could be 97 million, 82, it could be, you know, probably if you rank them all, you know, it could be by descent exaggerated, but in most cases, the most likely outcome then is zero, because it can be zero or something else. And I just wonder in practice, whether in practice most likely can be used to put it down to zero. So I have a conceptual problem with most likely, unless it's truly binary, you know, then so I just wonder how does most likely work out in practice?
Well,
I support most likely, and because you know that the I agree, Martin's I can understand Martin's argument, but the most likely is zero, is that it will not be, you know, recognized, but still that it is a kind of contingent liability. Therefore, you know that I think it should be disclosed in detail, nature, outcome or recovery amount, etc. But once that some certain recognition threshold is met, then most likely outcome number should not be zero. And it carries, I think, that the quite relevant information.
Okay, thanks. Bob?
I would concur with that. I'm a fan of more likely. The only comment I wanted to make is I think it's dangerous for standard setters to try and write into a standard to correct what may be a deficiency in practice. And I think that gets dangerous. And I think there is a practice issue with maybe companies going to zero when it really is not the most likely amount. But I think that should be fixed through regulation, through the audit community, through management being more honest, if you will. But I think it's very dangerous to try and fix it with standard.
So you wouldn't change IS-37?
No, not at all. Except the one thing I would change is get rid of the word probable in paragraph B and call it more likely than not, so you don't have to use parentheses every time.
Malcolm?
You know, I'm coming from an industry which at times has these sorts of challenges with these one-off cases. And, you know, you as standard setters have to understand the challenges and the time it takes actually to work out a settlement position, once you realize that you're going to have to do something, it's actually not easy to work out, you know, what your settlement position might be. And you have to be conscious. You cannot ask us as preparers to shoot ourselves in the feet. You know, if, say, we are thinking that, well, you know, we're going to have to put some offer on the table to this, whatever it might be, you know, there's a lot of internal processes that have to go through, you know. Obviously, we put off the evil day until the end, but once we've decided you have to accept something, then you've got internal processes, you go to the board. And the worst case is, you know, we're agonizing issues. You know, if it really becomes clear in, say, November, something has to happen, but it's going to, you know, take a long time to actually approach the different people to work out what the settlement process is. You cannot force us, so you should not be forcing us to shoot ourselves in the foot, say, at the end of the year, if we're actually only going to work out the settlement process, say in February. I mean, it can take a 4-month process. We internally, we're starting to say something's going to happen, but it's a long process. You have to be conscious. We cannot shoot ourselves in the feet and start to book a provision and make it very clear that that provision's there, and to ruin our own negotiation strategy. And that's you know.
So does IS37 make you do that at the moment?
I have to be careful, this is publicly recorded what I say, but we have to be very careful. So, you know, myself and my general counsel, and, you know, we obviously want to fully comply with standards, and we don't want to be accused that we have, you know, by regulators, that we're not respecting the right trigger point. But it's a very, you know, complex, the whole process, to work out what potentially. And so obviously, once we've made started to make a settlement offer, and it might be that, you know, in reality the settlement offer has to be doubled, but once we've made a settlement offer and put something on the table, we clearly have to book something. But that's why I would say you should. I mean, I understand all this stuff about expected value and most likely, but, you know, there's a practical side of this too, and you cannot ask preparers to, as I say, to ruin the negotiation strategy.
So does that mean
booking
zero,
something.
Malcolm? Or is it a number with no disclosure?
No, disclosure is always going to be there, Stephen. The point is, forcing people to home in on a number before one's really ready to do that is not really sensible. And I actually am hearing comforting noises, actually, I think, from around the table, that people are realizing putting inevitably the wrong figure in the accounts is also not helpful.
But minimum amounts, if they are available.
Minimum amounts, but they only, you know, in reality, you know, I'm fine. Once we've put an offer on the table, that is the minimum amount, because it's only going to go up. But you cannot put a minimum amount on the table and say, you know, I'm going to pay you 20, and then you put in your accounts 50 because you think that's the likely outcome.
On the other hand,
you shoot yourself in the foot.
Hold on. On the other hand, because this is real life, eh?
This is real life.
Yeah. If you are in litigation and there's like $1 billion claim, and you put on the table a minimum amount of 200, I mean, that's.
Yeah, but you can't. So yeah, then that's reality. That's reality. If you're
to disclose,
if
that
you're negotiating with somebody, you disagree with somebody building a house or something, you're not going to disclose the fact. Well, I'm going to offer you 20, but I'm going to pay you 50.
Okay, I think we need some further discussions on that. But in the interest of time, I think we will limit it now to these three comments, and then we hopefully to move to the next topic. Start with Mary, and then we have Sandra and Glenn, and then we move to the next.
We may not have time here, but one thing that strikes me in terms of measurement is whether we are being imprecise about our language, most likely, you know, entangling up the probability threshold with most likely outcome. And it was when Bob was speaking that it struck me, if we retain a threshold like the one we have in 37 today, if we do a project, and if in that project we retain a threshold like the one we have today, once you cross that threshold, but only once you cross that threshold, what are people's views about expected value versus most likely outcome? And the reason I ask that is because once you, if you are not recognizing anything when outflows are less than 50% probable, you're talking only about the realm of when you think it's probable you're going to be paying something, and putting aside the true binary outcomes, and I think that they are rare. I think the fact that we have, this is Bob's point about vocabulary, probable, you know, more likely than not, and you know, the phrase best estimate or most likely outcome may be confusing two things, because I think we're not talking about if you keep a threshold, then going back to expected value from, you know, from 5%, 10%, 15% probability. So I think we have to be precise in our language.
Sandra?
When you're thinking about litigation, I think cost benefit has to be an integral part of the analysis. And if you end up disclosing minimum amounts or expected settlements or anything like that, you've prejudiced your case, and the cost associated with that will outweigh the benefits that are perceived, or the incremental benefits that would be perceived, because you can achieve a lot by providing precise factual-based disclosure without having to put any additional information. And if it's a big case and the analysts that are following you, they're going to invest the time to understand where they think the outcome may be. But the cost aspect is critical in the litigation side. If you're talking about other types of liabilities, you know, warranty claims and things like that, it's different. But litigation, I think, needs its own set of sensitivities when you're thinking about it.
But would you be against disclosing the claimed amount? Because is that
it's a fact. I mean, it's
so that's
public
a fact. It's not a problem, I guess. Because
right.
The claimed amount is the claimed amount. I mean, it's
right.
Not more than that. It's not that you give in. That okay? That's the
even settlement amounts. You may put out a settlement amount to avoid future litigation costs, but if you decide to litigate, you know, that goes away, and perhaps your low end of the estimate is zero. You just didn't want to spend the cost to go through and litigate, and you think the likelihood is pretty strong that zero is the outcome.
Okay, Glenn?
I'm very unhappy at the idea that we might not disclose material information because it's part of a negotiating, because it queers a negotiating pitch. It seems to me that the purpose of accounting standards is to make sure that the market is able to trade information. Now, that having been said, I do understand that in the case of 37, so I agree with Malcolm, but not for the reasons he's given, that the data points are, you know, it's not necessary to get a particular number on these things, because I think it's in the nature of distributions that several numbers can be right. And so whether you're looking for, you know, and so the search for the sort of golden standard of expected value or most probable value, etc., may be a sort of blind alley here, because actually several numbers could be the right number, and they could be wildly different, and they could all be the right answer to the question. The market knows that, and I think that a description of the problem when it comes to that, and a disclosure, a narrative disclosure of those elements, allows people to go and make up their own assessment. So I think when we're dealing with these kind of very touchy-feely, very uncertain things, the market's going to have five views on it, and it's going to take five numbers, and they're going to be, and those who think it's higher will be, you know, if it's an asset, will be buying, and those who think it's low will be selling, and it'll be like that every day. It's just like that. There isn't a correct number. So maybe what I'm saying to you is, it doesn't really matter that much what number you put in at the end of the day here, whether it's expected value. So let's not kind of fret too much about this. if the narrative it gives the market enough data to be able to trade the information.
Okay, Glenn, thanks for that. And I think what we're hearing maybe is not so much appetite for a change, but maybe more disclosure. But I think we need some further discussions on that.